would tell us that, among other things, we must not hate our enemy. And we know from a political standpoint that there probably is nothing more disastrous to the morale of the world today than this psychological warfare between the socialized states and the democratic powers. It isn't really what either side is doing. It's what it might do. It's the long-range fear, the doubts, the uncertainties, the grievances, ever remembered, which is setting these two great groups against each other in a struggle to the death. If both groups could accept, just relax, Mr. Khrushchev could stop pounding desks with his shoe and settle down to the very simple fact that he is perhaps a rather lovable, funny old man. If he can look in the mirror and see himself deprived of his honors and estates, he might look like somebody's grandfather. And he would be much better off if he played the part. Because these things do not mean anything. Khrushchev may be one of these days removed from office by the familiar method. He may last a little while. If nothing else happens to him, nature will ultimately remove him. And he will have a life of shouting and howling, screaming and groaning, when he could have had a very happy time of it, and perhaps brought a lot of happiness to many other people. But all kinds of things that are not so move in. Great grievances that must be paid off. Great races of scientific power find out who can get to the moon first. The little question that we haven't gotten around to yet is, was the Earth going to be here when they get back from the trip? This doesn't seem to concern anyone. But this quiet process of acceptance simply lets down these tensions. In private life, it is such a very helpful thing, too. There are people who worry the moment their children leave the house, worry if they're not back within 5 minutes after school is out, worry if the husband is 15 minutes late getting home, worrying about this and that, a life of worry. No wonder these people are hard to get along with and hard to understand. These people are having trouble getting along with themselves because everything suddenly becomes tension. Everything becomes fear. There is no acceptance. How we can be a religious people and claim that we believe in a good God that protects us, and how we can affirm the spiritual power of prayer, how we can basically sense that this world is in the hands of an almighty providence, how we can have these feelings and then live from one uncertainty to another with 100 doubts in a single day and a natural instinct to interpret everything as negatively as possible. How such inconsistencies can exist is hard to understand. It can only mean that our religion hasn't gotten in where it is really taking care of things for us. But by acceptance, we can take most of the power out of the bomb. We can certainly take out of it its power to destroy our lives without ever going off. Under the existing conditions, we will produce a generation of nervous wrecks in which 2/3 of our population will ultimately become psychotic, and no bomb has been fired in this situation. True, two were fired. But in the great problem of things, we are living in a tremendous anxiety. And this anxiety will cost us 100 times the number of deaths caused by the fission of the largest bombs we could possibly create. Furthermore, this type of misery as a terrible chain reaction, far more dangerous to us than the mutations that can result from the bomb. Because we are creating a situation in society today of neurosis, of fear, of panic, of loss of personal integration, of breakdown, ethical and moral, which at the least we can say will require 10 generations of healthy living to remedy. And there is no prospect at the moment of the 10 generations of healthy living. We are actually afflicting the next 300 or 400 years of our existence with the attitudes that we are permitting today. So for those who really want a spiritual consolation, a real spiritual help in this situation, consider the problem of the significance of the factual. How every moment of the day can bring us great experience of beauty, a great enrichment of understanding. If we can just pause from the panic long enough to be quiet and to receive into ourselves something of the ever-present availability of good. If we can only get away from these exaggerations, we can achieve a great deal that is valuable and important. The next thing that naturally arises in connection with this concept is the reconciliation of our concept of God with the concept of the bomb. Somehow the bomb caused us to sort of feel that maybe we were too much even for God to handle. But somehow God couldn't prevent the bomb. That this power in man, which is God, was inadequate to prevent man's own abuse of this power. I think we have to revise this thinking a little bit, too. For thousands of years, we believed in hell, very literal hell, with nice barbecues in it, with our enemies and the members of other beliefs turning on spits and being basted by assorted demons. Actually, in New England, we were taught in the 17th century that not only this hell was there with all our relatives toasting, but those of the true faith who survived this ordeal and didn't land in hell were on a wonderful sort of promenade deck where they could look down on all this and sing psalms of happy glory while they watched their parents broil. Now, we believe this. It's just how stupid we can be. But we believed it in a good faith. We honestly thought this was true. It never occurred to us to wonder in what part of the nature of God hell was located. How a universe composed and created by God, fashioned by the divine will and sustained by the divine wisdom, just what part of it would be set aside for perdition? We never got around even figuring that out. It came finally to our realization that there was hell. That hell had to be in God. This became less and less attractive as a thought, and we gradually got over it. Now, where in this same picture is the atomic bomb? Is this atomic bomb, or perhaps 100 other things that we will invent in the future, is this great problem that we are presently facing one which actually involves a disillusionment in the nature of God? I don't think that we have any right to assume that such is the case. In the first place, we are dealing only with the most remote extremities of the divine plan. We are dealing only with matter. Actually, atomic fission has occurred by natural causes in space from the beginning. Worlds have exploded and gone to nothing. Universes have come into being. Creatures and creations lived and died. But the universal processes go on. I don't think that the atomic bomb represents a universal or divine emergency at all. It represents nothing more or less than a rare example of human stupidity. If this planet and all that it inhabits were to be blown into space, even modern science would be hesitant to suggest that anything had died or that anything had been destroyed. Things had been changed. Change as a mutation everywhere occurring in nature. It is very doubtful if we can assume that the atomic situation is any more a danger to the spiritual program of life than the most common accidents and occurrences. It is more spectacular, but probably in no sense essentially different. The atomic bomb cannot touch the great universal pattern, for it is only a fragment, a minute fragment, in one tiny part of that pattern. Now, it is true that all kinds of consequences might come to man, but these consequences relate only to the external physical existence of things. I believe that we will ultimately demonstrate scientifically that we can destroy man's body with a bomb, but that we cannot destroy his soul. That the moment we escape from the peculiar boundary of matter, a boundary which forms walls, houses, doors, and prisons, but does not create any of the lives in these things, that this bomb cannot touch any essential value that would not also be susceptible to worms and dry rot. It is more spectacular, but it is not essentially different. The body of man ultimately disintegrates. We have never held this to be a great evil. The circumstances of this disintegration have no effect upon the essential fact. And here we have to be factual again. We, of course, a wholesale destruction of life by atomic means might work a considerable hardship upon the morticians. But it will not change the essential nature of man. The only thing that can happen to him is to have him blown out of a body. And this is not essentially different from the fact that he may be thrown out of it in any one of 100 ways. His chances of being destroyed by a bomb, according to some modern statistics, are about, we will say, 1 in 100. In comparison to his chances of being killed on a freeway. A freeway is far more dangerous than the bomb. Also, whether we realize it or not, common aspirin is more dangerous than the bomb. Alcohol is 1,000 times more dangerous than the bomb. Because at least a greater part of the victims of the bomb are more or less clear casualties. Some are not. Those that are near the center of the bomb certainly are. But in alcohol, every individual is a continuing casualty. A terrible, gradual destruction. These things, however, have never worried us. It is because we are not factual. We have said this is death and this is death, but death is not death. If you die this way, it's a disaster. If you die that way, it's an achievement. factually, we move from this condition into another. And whether we are moved by the bomb, or whether we are moved by the neglect of a common cold, is of very little essential difference. We do have a certain inability to plan our future. But in religion, we've abused that kind of planning too long anyway. We have abused the concept of retirement ever since we had it. We have abused the idea of procrastination, of putting things off until some other better day. It never came, but we did have a certain belief in it. These changes will be of considerable use to us. That everything is shortened, intensified, and vitalized. And if we can face each day with a sense of the totality of that day, we can achieve tremendous satisfaction and security and peace. The individual who knows how to live is always ready to die. For it is the end of our religion, whatever our faith may be, that it shall help us to live well and to die with a good hope of the future. Therefore, our religion has to give us the strength to die well. And what kind of people die well? Usually, the individual whose inner life has been matured and who has a deep and abiding faith in the universal values which underlie existence. Therefore, religion bestows upon us a peace in this transition, even as it sustains us during the years of our sojourn here. In this, the atom bomb brings again a message to us. It tells us that we should live always, today, so that by character, by understanding, by insight, we are always ready to leave this world in dignity. That we are ready, whenever the call comes, to leave without regret, without fear, but only with a great hope of the future. This means that to leave here without regret, we've got to sort of put things here in order a little better than we have them. We can't leave things here without regret if all our hope, all our faith, all our confidence is locked into these things which we must leave. Buddha tells us very definitely that the wise person, the truly factual person, delivers himself from the tragedy of his own possessions. Most people who are unable to die well have this terrible confusion in the end because they are bound more to this world than they are to the principles of life and truth. Consequently, this simple fact problem that we have already mentioned has an application here. That we must realize that we never own anything. We must realize that at any point in our career, we can safely rest. That nothing that we are doing here is really very important as a thing. A man has a great project. He wishes to build a new city in California. Probably too many men in California have already had this idea. Those towns are springing up like mushrooms. But this is to be his great life work. So in the midst of it, he develops strange symptoms and is told he only has 6 months to live. This is a tragedy, because he has already plans for 10 years, and perhaps incidentally $10 million. Here is a horrible disaster that has happened to him. The bottom is out of the universe as far as he is concerned. There is no justice anywhere. But what this man was never able to be was factual. He should have known from the beginning that every day was a day with certain hazards. Every day he rode out to his project, any one of those rides could well have been his last. He wasn't factual. He didn't realize that the real problem was not that he finished the project. The problem was, what did he learn working with the project? He might have labored for another 10 years on that project and not been a bit better man than he was the day he died. It is not that he would finish the project that nature was interested in. What nature was interested in is how much did he grow from working with the project. What did he learn about human hearts? How did he enrich his own character? How did he stand up against the temptation of corruption? Was he honorable? Was he true? Did he do a job well? Were his motives right? These are the things that nature was interested in. Nature was not at all concerned with whether his dreams came true or not. Nature's problem was, what was the dream? Was the dream itself true? For this was the thing that man took with him into an eternal existence. So by attaching ourselves too positively to the things, we sense the danger of loss. We huddle. We grasp the things we want to hold on to. We go into panic at the possibility of losing them, forgetting entirely that we must all lose all of them. So Zen again sits down and says, we must lose them when we die. Why not lose them while we're alive? And therefore have peace in the last 25 years, instead of a desperate struggle to hold on to something that must slip away. Why cling to these things when we cannot actually win? There is no being known in history that has ever won the fight to hold on to anything. Yet each day we try it, because we're not factual. Factually, we have right usage. The things that make life better for us, the things that make experience richer, we can delight in, we can enjoy them. But they come and they go. With happiness, we receive them. With happiness, we must release them. If we do that, fear has no longer this hold upon us. Perhaps the atomic age will remind us even more acutely how little we can possess. And perhaps it may go so far as to overthrow this concept that status is possession. The only reason why possession is important is because men think it's important. And if they change their patterns, possession will no longer be a symbol of status, and we will not care nearly so much about it. Perhaps it will take a bomb to remind us that we bring nothing but ourselves into this life, and we can take out of this life nothing but ourselves. Also, perhaps the bomb will give us a new dimension of spiritual integrity about people. Actually, people are very wonderful creatures. They're troublesome at times, but they are still very wonderful people. They are very worth knowing, very worth understanding. And there are tremendous possibilities in human relationships that have never been touched under the strange psychology by which we live. We have set up a pattern by which it is almost impossible for an individual to be himself. We have surrounded him with innumerable artificial factors. We have decreed this and declared that. And we have bound this individual into a series of patterns and defenses which we are almost unable to break through. If we live in a moment in which now is our life, perhaps we will suddenly wake up to the fact that it is no longer necessary or important to play games, to make all kinds of strange and foolish attitudes and try to nurse them. We will no longer be expected to put on appearances and to various ways deceive each other or exploit each other. In hours of great emergency, people truly become people. In those moments, all the little things are forgotten. All the pettiness seems to disappear. I've seen this in areas where some natural disaster struck. People who never spoke to each other were suddenly friends because of need. Something big opens up in the individual in an emergency. Well, we have an emergency, and we hope that something big will open up in all men. That suddenly there won't be any more shamming. There won't be any more make-believe. But that values will be straight. We won't be able to afford subterfuge because our period of possible association is too uncertain. So, leaving all the sham, the make-believe behind, we can meet as human beings. We can serve each other as human beings. We can give and accept as human beings. We will not have to worry and fuss and fume over the long-range strategies with which we hope to exploit or afflict each other. Now is the only time for that true friendship, for that true understanding, for that immediate meeting of hearts and minds in which we can have honest associations in life. The bomb may make dishonesty no longer very helpful or important. There's very little use in stealing from another man if you're going to die yourself with the goods in your hands a few hours later. It makes very little difference about these kind of things. But there are values that are so tremendous that we can live a lifetime in an hour. These values have to come into their own. And they always should have. Man had 60 or 70 years, 80 years perhaps, to learn how to live. Perhaps now he must gain this same experience by what might be termed an intensive course, somewhat shorter in duration. But he can still graduate with honors. He can still do all of the things that were ever important that he ever could do. But he must do them now, instead of putting off forever this day of attainment. Religion then suggests the motion of belief, perhaps, toward this idea of the one world faith. The one world faith in which we no longer have any time left for who is right and who is wrong. We have no longer any time for the careful consideration of the historical aspects of theology. If a man has only a few years to live, does he want to spend this time debating orthodoxy? He would probably laugh and say, no, he doesn't. If he does want to spend it that way, there's something definitely wrong with the man. If we have all the time in the world, we can waste it in arguing. But if we haven't so much time, there are much more important things that we can do if we must conserve resources. And when we stop conserving our time resources, the first thing to do is to stop those things which only waste time. One of them is religious debate, which has never been won by anyone because the simple facts are not available beyond a certain point, and everyone immediately goes beyond that point into a very rarefied atmosphere where no one knows what he's talking about. And the fact that 100 have come to the same conclusion about something none of them understood does not constitute scientific knowledge. So the process is comparatively worthless. Religion becomes, to the individual then, an available instrument of orientation. Religion becomes the only way in which a person can live happily in an uncertain state. Religion becomes the pacifier of the inner life of man, helping him to maintain his values so that they are never shaken by the tempests of outer things. Religion is then reduced to its essential, an essential we've never gotten around to really working with. And that is its immediate power to affect beneficially the life of the believer. Religion must work rapidly, like everything else, if time is short. There are three or four essential principles of religion which can be disseminated rapidly. They are the ones that we've always held to be the most important, but which we do not always emphasize. For example, if we had the Bible in front of us, and we did not know how long we were going to live, we might not wish to start with Genesis and end with Revelation. We might not quite get to Revelation. We might be caught in the midst of the first Thessalonians or something of that nature, and that would be the end of us. But what would we be most likely to do if we knew or had some plan? We would choose those sections which would be most helpful and consoling and strengthening to us. And if we could only read a few pages of that book or a very small fragment, I suspect that most Christian people would read the Sermon on the Mount. The rest of it would sort of get lost. We wouldn't have time to fool with it. It would be nice if we had forever. We could even read the Begats, which might go on for hours and hours and hours. But certainly, if our lives were uncertain, we would not linger over the Begats. In the same way, in surveying our religious life, if our problems are real and intense, we wouldn't wander through this endless problem of bickering and differing, of arguing and fighting, of combating and refuting that has disfigured religion for thousands of years. We would go after the facts that we can use. And the facts that we can use are, for the most part, very simple, things that a child can understand. And having understood them, apply them. Now, the difference between a religious or sacred book and an ordinary book is that a sacred book is said to represent, or is held to represent, an affirmation of spiritual fact, either revealed by God to man or revealed by God through man, through the experience of ages. Therefore, there is a certain solemn assurance in these words, that they represent truths, unchanging, timeless, and that these truths constitute a pattern of conduct acceptable to God and space and nature. That is all religion of religion we need. these simple statements that represent our essential covenant with the spiritual source of life. So our religions will have to be simplified if we're going to live in a space atom age. I think someday we're going to have a new kind of Bible, which I think might be very interesting. I think we might have a Bible that contains about 10 short chapters. And each one of these chapters is composed of the noblest, the most sublime, and the most eternally true statement to be found in each of the religions of the world. We could put this in our pocket. It doesn't make any difference whether it's from the Vedas or the Koran. Is it true? Is it a statement made so peculiarly well, with such deep penetration of insight, that it strikes directly into our own heart and into our own need? And in probably 20 or 30 pages, the religion of man can be revealed to man. The rest is darkness. The rest is uncertainty. So religion in an age of constant pressure must be sublimated into its very essence. And that essence must be given to man. We worried very much about the problems, for instance, of teaching religion in public schools. We don't think we should take a people and indoctrinate them with a religious concept, especially when we have a polyglot culture. This is all right. I don't say we should. I can see many reasons why it might be a good idea if we could, but perhaps the way things are, it is better not to. But if we once can get this concept of a one world faith, a one religion for one humanity, these 20 chapters that I'm mentioning, or dozen chapters, summarizing the wisdom of all men, could very well be a textbook, perhaps for reading in the fourth or fifth grade, by means of which man would be actually educated from the very text of the greatest convictions of his race, and would grow up with these convictions in his heart. Perhaps then we might get around to teaching man to read in school in order that he might be able to understand some of these things. The moment we get past the creeds, to get down to the principles, we're not going to have these unhappy mothers and fathers storming the board of supervisors or the board of parent teachers moving in on something every time a little morality is taught to one of our children. I was present when one mother jumped up at a meeting and said she did not want ethics to be taught to her child in school because she wanted her child to go out in the world and get rich. Now, this is the situation. Now, how are you going to cope with it? But I do believe that if this mother suddenly realizes that the boy might not live long enough to go out in the world and get rich, perhaps she'd be a little more interested in him being a good boy now. But it is this long future. Mother will be gone long before the son, probably, would get to the zenith of his career. She is leaving him as a bit of unfinished business in the universe and going on her own way. She will not live to see, in all probabilities, the tragedy resulting from her own short-sightedness. But we don't need this type of situation. We can shorten all these things down, as most of them should be shortened. And we can gradually build into this situation the simple fact of our spiritual need, and this is our religion for the future. We can read our whole sacred book before breakfast, but it'll take us as long as we can live to apply it. But things have got to be shortened down. They've got to be made available to the individual who does not have time. Not because he is too busy making money, but because he is too near to the unknown. All this long-range planning has become meaningless. Years ago, Henry Ford, before he died, said that a generation would arise after him in which the virtue of the long-range plan would disappear. For generations, everyone planned for the future. And in planning for the future, forgot to be anything now. Everyone was reaching beyond himself. He never paused to consider himself. He was out conquering the world. He never stopped long enough to look inside of himself and see what he was trying to conquer with. These problems were not important. But suddenly this vast panorama is foreshortened. Everything must be brought into immediate fulfillment. World peace must come now. It cannot any longer be pushed off to an unborn generation. Juvenile delinquency must be met now. It cannot longer be delayed. Crime, poverty, these things must be handled now, because now is the only time we have. And our religion must grow in us now. Our philosophy of life must develop in us now. The good things must be done now. This seems to mean we haven't very much time to work with. But now let us take a life for a moment and see just exactly what now means. Supposing we say that without bombs, freeways, or phenobarbital, we would have a 30 or 40 year life expectancy. What would this really actually mean? What does it mean? What does this period of life expectancy mean in the actual achievement of things? How much will we have of real life and thought? With a lifelong career of that nature stretching out ahead, we really have a good opportunity to get well absorbed into something. Here we have the chance of rising in the business, which used to be, in the old days, the big thought. Instead of higher pay, as we think now, the thing that was dangled in front of the young employee was that he would rise in the business. To rise in the business meant that if he was faithful and honest for 46 years, he might rise to the degree of being head cashier. And when he retired, if he lived to retire, he would receive a glorious grandfather's clock with large chimes in it that would awake him on the hour and for the rest of his life. This was rising in the business. This was something that really was tremendous. In order to do this, you had to be faithful unto death. In fact, you had to be half dead to succeed at it. This would take two-thirds of your waking time for the entire period. And as you got down through this situation and found out how much time your wages actually bought for you, and then considered what you tried to do with that time in order to be able to get back to work the next day, and these little outings which were desperate escapes from the marvelous opportunity of rising in the business, and the responsibilities of family and other duties, I would suspect that a man with, say, 40 years perspective might actually have a year of actual time which he could use to understand himself, to grow, to perfect or develop some instinct in his own consciousness. Perhaps all the time he ever had for that during the 40 years was the hour on Sunday morning when he went to church. Thus this 40 years did not give him any particular advantage. If he had been freed from some of these involvements, he might very well have adjusted internally, awakened internally, grown, unfolded in consciousness, just about as much in 6 months or a year of real application as he could in this entire period of time. It has been proven in public schools that this idea that a child has to have 16 years of schooling before it can graduate is ridiculous. It doesn't have to. With proper methods of instruction, the average child can learn all that it is necessary for it to know in half the time. But we can't get around to making anything practical. In life, this shortening of time in no way essentially means that we are deprived of opportunity. It simply means we've got to recognize opportunity and do something with it. We can live 40 years before we recognize it, or we can recognize it immediately. We have a relativity factor here, which I think will play a very important part as we go on down through time. Evasions, avoidances, procrastinations don't mean much anymore. Also, we have no way to escape the psychological consequences of the intensifying of situations that have already existed. The atomic threat has simply pressed together all of the problems of humanity into one package and dumped it on our doorstep. They're not new problems, they're the same old ones. But they are not spread as they were. They are now brought into a compact mass, and they have to be faced as such. With this basic concept, we have wonderful opportunity to make the adjustments. If we fail to make these adjustments, what is going to happen? We're going to break up now, before the bomb ever does it. We're going to suddenly realize in a comparatively short time that either we have to have religion or we can't make it. The entire processes of abnormal psychology have been speeded up. The neurotic, who might have drifted half sick through a long life, now breaks in 3 months because of pressure. This doesn't mean that he wasn't sick before. But he is now completely sick, quickly. Whereas otherwise he would be half sick for the rest of his life. He must therefore face this problem and find his remedy now. He also has many more inducements to find a remedy. Many people have gone along through life half sick for 50 years and never known it because they have never experienced a healthy day. They've considered their own peculiar psychotic state as quite normal. Everyone else was crazy. But this condition will not prevail. The individual under psychic stress is breaking quickly, which is only telling us that he was never strong enough to stand the stress. Also, it is telling us what is wrong with civilization, what is wrong with education, what is wrong with culture. It is telling us, beyond any question of doubt, the weakness of the entire structure under which we live. And it's bringing this to us fast and hard. The only way we can solve the problem is catch the ball now and quick. So this is how the entire spiritual problem sums up. That suddenly we are confronted with immediate needs for immediate action, that everything we believe will be tested quickly. It will be found sufficient or not sufficient. If it is not sufficient, we will know it now. And if we have common sense, we will do something about it now. But all the dilly-dallying, all the theological arguments, all the long struggle of the sects to justify their own religious opinion, all the traditions and the precedents and the policies are suddenly brought as to a final judgment. They are weighed in the balance. And all that we have believed, all that we have talked about, all we have read about, either helps now or it will never help. We've put off applications, so we haven't realized fallacy. But out of this can come the greatest awakening that the world has ever known. It can transform us from a people without direction, without intention, drifting along a path of least resistance into a dynamic group, suddenly recognizing the magnitude of its own need and the immediacy of its own problem. Out of these things can be fashioned the elements of a new religious conviction. And this is the kind of conviction we have to have if we are going to be well now, if we are going to be able to go to bed and sleep tonight, and if we are able to get up in the morning tomorrow and go and do the good things of the day without first frightening ourselves out of our wits. Also, we are going to free ourselves from those strange dreams that trouble the darkness. We're going to take no part in these squabbles and arguments that can never mean anything, whether they are lost or won. We're going to be quiet. We're going to strengthen our inner conviction. We're going to clarify our own inner faith. We're going to find what help we need quickly, because we have to have it quickly. And we're going to devote our years and our times to the fulfillment of those things most meaningful to us in the largest terms. If we begin to live this way, you know, it's quite possible that the bomb won't fall. Because one of the reasons why it is likely to fall is because we have lived stupidly. If we improve, we may also have the skill, the wisdom, and the insight to escape this hazard, because the bomb will only be used to frighten or to destroy or to intimidate or to bewilder. And if man does not react to these physical temptations to panic, there is very little to be gained. There is no way of breaking the spirit of man. There is no way of intimidating him. There is no way of enslaving him if he lives with a clear internal vision of value. And out of this type of thinking, perhaps we can build a religion that would be pretty useful and which we have long needed. And now perhaps we'll have the incentive to perfect and apply. Well, time's up, so I guess we have to quit.